The weather in Central Ohio just got better, so why shouldn't your loan rate? CME Federal Credit Union wants to try to beat your current loan rate by 2% on autos and toys. Plus, enjoy no payments for 90 days on car loans and no payments for 60 days on motorcycles, boats, and more. With car rates as low as 4.99% APR and toy rates starting at 6.5% APR, it's the perfect time to save. Apply today at cmefcu.org.
Terms apply. Minimum floor rates, 4.99% APR cars, 6.50% APR other vehicles. Federally insured by NCUA.
Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the latest episode of The Interviews, the Empire podcast spin-off, which rounds up the cream of our chats with filmdom's finest. Lee Cronin's The Mummy, that is its official name in a very John Carpenter-style flex, is the first film from the Irish horror director since he revitalized the Evil Dead franchise with Evil Dead Rise a couple of years ago, and now he's hoping to do the same for The Mummy. This isn't the fun, frothy, Fraser and Feist-led adventure we've come to associate with The Mummy over the past few decades, but a return to the character's horror roots. Universal monsters, Hammer horror, all that jazz, as a family are reunited with their long-lost daughter, Katie, only to find that Katie may not be all she seems. Whoa. And so the scene is set for the kind of gnarly, gory scares that seem destined to cover bandages in blood. Irish actor Jack Rayner stars as the mummy's daddy, Charlie, and I popped on the Zoom just last week to have a natter about splatter with him. We also talked about working with Natalie Grace, who plays the returned Katie buried under layers of makeup, Rayner's love of genre, and much, much more. You never guess what. Enjoy.
Jack, welcome to the Empire podcast. How are you?
Thank you. It's great to be here. I love Empire.
Oh, no, the feeling is mutual. Where in the world are you at the moment, sir?
I am currently in Los Angeles. I'm finishing filming Presumed Innocent Season 2 on Apple.
All right. Are you innocent or guilty?
Oh, I can't tell you. I can't tell you that. That's what it's all about.
I'm presuming there might be some innocence, maybe.
You can presume. You'll just have to wait and see.
Anyway, we're not here to talk about that. We're here to talk about Lee Cronin's The Mummy. And I've seen a lot of mummy movies over the years. And I imagine, like me, you were intrigued by the fact, by the Lee Cronin's part of that.
Certainly.
This is very much his movie.
Yeah, I am a huge Evil Dead fan. And I think that Lee did a great job with his movie of striking the balance between doing something really fresh and also kind of it fulfilling what the fandom were going to want. I think that humor is a huge part of the Evil Dead franchise, and he was able to make the horror so over the top in that movie that you had no choice but to laugh your way through it, because otherwise you were going to be crying. So I knew that I'd be in safe hands with regards to The Mummy, because this could only be a very fresh take on what had come before. And, you know, so I sat down to read the script. It just so happened that, like, one of my best pals is producing this movie as well, McDara Kelleher. I'm a fan of Blumhouse and James Wan, obviously. So, you know, I had a sense that this was going to be something very fresh. And then when I read the script, it was like, oh, this has much more in common with The Ring or with The Grudge than it has with the Brendan Fraser, adventure movie, Indiana Jones adjacent mummy. This is something that's a movie about a vengeful ghost. This is a family who have failed to protect their daughter, and she comes back later with just pure rage. And it's a family issue that can't be resolved, but can't be run away from either. So that's something really different. That's something really new for The Mummy as a legacy of films.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. You know, I've read many interviews with you, and you've said in the past that you're a genre head. So, yeah. And you know, being a big Evil Dead fan, brownie points for that. You're talking to someone who considers Evil Dead 2 to be the greatest movie of all time.
Unbelievable.
amazing film. So you know your way around genre, you know your way around horror as well. So it's not just necessarily the Brendan Fraser, you know, Rachel Weisz, Mummy adventure movies and we're thinking about with this. We're thinking about Hammer films. We're thinking about the Universal.
Boris Karloff. Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, people in bandages walking around very, very slowly. And and this is not that. This is brutal and feral.
Yeah. And by the way, like, I would recommend for anybody to go back and look at the Boris Karloff film as well, because that is still a freaky fucking movie, man. That's a terrifying film. Really effective, really good. One of the first movies that was kind of a talkie as well. You know, it's kind of a hybrid. It's half silent film, but they were getting the technology and they were able to put some dialogue into it. Very effective movie, even still today. And I love the Hammer stuff. I had the pleasure of working in Bray Studios on Citadel just before I shot The Mummy. And, you know, I'm walking around that lot and seeing this place where they shot all these great Hammer movies that I love. And so to come back home to Ireland afterwards and to go to Ardmore Studios, there's a very similar vibe in Ardmore. And, you know, a lot of the kind of classic Irish films were made there. So for us to make such a genre movie there with such ambition was a big kick, man. I just loved being back with an Irish crew, with a lot of friends, you know, people I've known since I was 3 years old, people I've worked with throughout my career as an actor. It was such a brilliant experience. And we were all just like, we were so proud to be there, you know. It was great, very fulfilling.
Was it wild in a way? I want to talk about, you know, the character and dig into the film as much as we can.
Yeah.
But was it wild in a way, because you're doing an American accent in this and, you know, you're in Ireland with an Irish director and all of a sudden you have to be an American. Did that pose problems at all?
Only insofar as the whole crew, who were all friends of mine, taking the piss out of me for my accent all the time.
So, that's what you need. You need great. That that's encouraging great for your friends, conference. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Had to ADR the whole fucking movie. But no, it was fine. It was fine. But it is weird, you know, like when you're at home in your own bed in County Wicklow in Ireland and you drive over the Wicklow Gap in the morning and then you get into a giant box basically and go, okay, now I'm in Egypt or now I'm in, you know, New Mexico or whatever. It's cool. And I mean, to be honest with you, when we were shooting the film, I knew that we weren't doing that adventure franchise movie.
Yeah.
And there's a sense that maybe the film's going to feel smaller as a result because a lot of it's shot on stages. But honestly, like when I watched the movie, I was like, fuck, this movie actually really has a lot of scope, you know? Like you can feel that the money is on the screen with this movie. And I was really happy with that, really proud of it.
How much did you know about the script the first time you read it? Because you seemed to suggest there that when you read it, it was a bit of a voyage of discovery for you.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I think partly the thing that's great about Lee is that he loves making movies so much and he loves making cinema movies, you know, things that are like theater events. And I think he's very, very good at it. And I think he's only going to grow as a household name as a result. He's really open to collaboration. He hires people in good faith and then he trusts them, which I couldn't say that about all directors, particularly not all auteurs. And so there was a sense coming to set with a love of film, a love of the genre of horror, that we were all getting in there and going, well, what if we do this? And, oh, fuck, wouldn't that be kind of gross if we made it be that, you know? So it was a sort of a collaboration and a voyage of discovery throughout the process. But let me be unequivocally clear. He knew where he wanted to go with this movie. He knew how he wanted it to feel. He knew how he wanted it to end up. And I think that he really achieved his aims, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting. Going back to that idea I said at the beginning that you know what you're getting when you hear Lee Cronin's The Mummy, that he's setting it deliberately aside from pretty much every iteration we've seen before. This is such an original take on this concept. Mm. And having the confidence, you know, just a couple of films into his career, really, to go, all right, this is a possessive credit. This is Lee Cronin's The Mummy. You know, not many directors have done that since John Carpenter, really, which surprises me because it's such a kick-ass thing to do.
Well, there you go. That's just the size of his fucking ego, isn't it?
And yet he strikes me as a very humble, unapproachable guy.
That's the thing, you know. It's the duality is insane. I think Lee is a very humble guy, and as I say, he's a very collaborative guy, and he works with people in good faith. But at the same time, I think he should be an acknowledgement of the fact that he has a very unique flavor of cinema right now. And I love the fact that he kind of takes possession of the title in that way. And I think it helps the film to stand further apart from the legacy of what's been there before, you know, but at the same time, you know, this is a Mummy movie, you know what I mean? Which is great.
Jack, I know you've made short films and stuff. Have you been thinking about directing full-time features as well?
I have. And I'm thinking about making a horror film, actually, a psychological horror film. I'm not going to tee it up, but it's something that's based on a very old piece of material. And I think it could be really great. It's something that, you know, I've discussed with Lee a little bit here and there, just softly, but I've been working flat out for the last kind of 2 years now. I haven't really had much time to stop and dig into my own stuff. But when I get back to Ireland soon, I think I'm going to start really putting pen to paper and working towards getting a feature in the can over the next, hopefully, 2 years, you know?
That would be amazing. Would you go possessive credit? Would you go Jack Rayner's whatever?
Jack Rayner's. I don't know if I have the balls for that just yet. Maybe I'll see if we can get two or three features done and dusted before I start doing the possessive title.
You say that Carpenter was pretty much right off the gate. He was just like, yep, I'm John Carpenter. This is my movie. He was. You like it or love it? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's dead right, you know? I mean, if you have the skills to pull it off, then why not? You know what I mean?
I've talked to you in the past, and I know that you're obviously a huge film fan as well. Where did that come from? Is that something that you've had always growing up?
I grew up loving films. And I think, you know, when I was a kid, I remember we had like a tiny little TV in our living room. Like, it was really small little TV from the 80s, and you had to like stick a nail file into the power button to make it work. It was really busted up, and it had four channels buttons, and that was all that was on it. And it had the old cable before the SCART cable, whatever cable that was, that you plug in for like a VHS or whatever. And I used to watch movies as a kid on the VHS, and I remember always wanting to be there. And like, it wasn't that I wanted to be an actor because I wanted to play the role, and it wasn't that I wanted to be the actor myself. I wanted to be in the world because it looked so exciting. It looked like something that was just amazing to be there, you know? Mm. And that stayed with me all through my life and all through my time in school. And so ultimately, when I reached the age where I was able to start to pursue a career myself, you know, it's wish fulfillment for me, man. I'm literally living my childhood dream. I love it. Every day that I'm on set, you know, some days it's hard, absolutely, but I love being in films. I love making TV. I feel so grateful to be able to do it.
In terms of what you were saying there about, you know, when you're watching movies as a kid growing up and, you know, you wanted to be in those worlds, have there been moments, you know, obviously on set you've got all the artifice of cameras and crew members and all sorts of stuff, but have there been moments when you felt really totally immersed in the world of the director?
Here's the thing, right? All the cameras and all that artifice is usually only on one side of the room at a time. So sometimes you're on a set or you're shooting in a location and all the cameras are here, but if you turn around, you're in the world. And that is incredible. And, you know, I worked with a director one time, Cedric Jimenez. We did a film that it's called The Man with the Iron Heart.
Yeah.
And it's a World War II film. And I remember him saying, listen, as a director, 90% of my job is creating an authentic world around you for you to do your thing in. 10% of it is for me to guide you to the performance that we need. But if I can really create the world, I don't need to direct you. You'll just do it yourself. And I think that was a very astute point. And, You know, there have been times, you know, even on like really big stuff that's totally, you know, outside the realms of realism, you know, like even Transformers.
Yeah.
There's times when you're on this set that's been built so meticulously and everybody who's working on this thing is working at the highest level imaginable. And you turn around and you go, holy shit, they have created this world and I'm just standing in it now. That's unbelievable, man. It's incredible.
And on this movie then, I don't want to give away too much, but when Katie returns into Charlie's life, how did that world feel? Those scenes where, you know, you are face to face with your daughter and there's that element, I guess it's a little bit like something like The Omen, where you're the parent who's not that sure about your kid anymore, but you also have, you got that tug of war between parental love and also revulsion and fear as well.
Yeah.
How immersive were those scenes? How immersive was that set in order to get you into that headspace?
Absolutely. Very immersive. Look, from the production design perspective, this movie was unbelievable. You know, like that team did an extraordinary job of building this house that a lot of the film takes place in. It was very, very, very immersive. I think for me, you know, what my character was driven by was the tension around his responsibility as a father and, you know, the guilt that makes him kind of just want to run away from the whole thing. And you'll probably have noticed there's some like neo-noir elements in this film. Like Charlie is an investigator in the movie. That investigation is taking him away from the responsibility to just rehabilitate his daughter. He's going on a hero's journey, so he doesn't really have to focus on the family in many respects. And I think, you know, for me, it was like, between Lee's direction, the ideas that we were coming up with, the production design, her performance, it was an incredibly rich world. And by the way, I also have to give so much credit to Laya and Veronica as well. You know, and like our like the other kids in the movie, you know, like Shiloh and Billy were so brilliant. Like they everybody created such an immersive world that it was, you know, it was easy to do it, man. It was easy to do it.
Do you remember the first time you saw Katie, Natalie in full makeup?
Yeah. So we, you know, we had Arian who was on prosthetics and he's brilliant. He's one of the best in the world. I saw some conceptual images for her before, you know, she came to set, but Lee and Arian made sort of a decision that they never wanted to show anyone on the cast or crew any practical tests that they did before we wheeled her out on set for the first day. So the crew were called, everybody stood around in the hall of the house downstairs, and she was just wheeled into the room. And there was this sort of a muted applause because everybody was freaked the fuck out and they were chilled when they saw her. Absolutely chilled. All of our blood just ran cold. So it was amazing, you know. It was so immersive for us, but for her, she did 7 hours of prosthetics every day to get into that thing, you know, every single day. And the patience that it took from her to just stand there, get into that 7 hours of prosthetics, and then come to work and put in such a physical performance and such an energetic performance, you know, extremely demanding. Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Jesus Christ. That's amazing.
Yeah. And Natalie's an extraordinary performer. Great.
Oh my God. That's absolutely wild. That sort of stuff is nightmarish. The idea of being that long in a makeup chair.
Oh my God. She had her own horror movie going on just with that. Yeah.
Jesus, yeah.
That was the psychological horror movie for her.
Jack, I'm going to let you go. It's been a pleasure. Thanks
great
so much.
Great to talk to you, man. Thanks a million.
The weather in Central Ohio just got better, and so should your loan rate. CME Federal Credit Union wants to try to beat your current loan rate by 2% on autos and toys. Plus, enjoy no payments for 90 days on car loans and no payments for 60 days on motorcycles, boats, and more. With car rates as low as 4.9% APR and toy rates starting at 6.5% APR, it's the perfect time to save. Apply today at cmefcu.org. Terms apply. Minimum floor rates 4.99% APR car, 6.5% APR other vehicles. Federally insured by NCUA.
Okay, that was Jack Rayner, and Lee Cronin's The Mummy is out in cinemas from this
Friday. Already out in cinemas is James McAvoy's directorial debut, California Schemin', which tells the mostly true story of two young kids from Dundee, Gavin and Billy, whose attempts to become Scotland's first successful rap duo are thwarted by a snooty record industry who turn their noses up at the first sign of a Scottish accent. Jings! So, Gavin and Billy, or Syllable and Brains to give them their rap duo name, game the system by pretending to be from America instead. Cue one record deal and a short-lived stab at fame before the inevitable happens. It's an excellent debut behind the camera for McAvoy, who mounted a long search to find his Syllable and Brains in the shape of young Scottish actor Seamus MacLean Ross, who plays Gavin, and English actor Samuel Bottomley, who plays Billy. The two of them are superb in the movie, and I went along to the film's junket recently to talk to them about their experiences. Now, usually at junkets, our interviews are either recorded for us by a specialist crew, or I record them myself on my A-grade podcast equipment. However, due to a scheduling snafu here, that wasn't the case. Instead, I had to record this chat with Samuel and Seamus on my iPhone. So, while I will do my best to fix it in post, this is probably not going to sound as good as our interviews normally do. But on the upside, I think this captures their personalities tremendously. They are enormous fun to be around, and I had a real giggle with them. A quick bit of context here. Just before we sat down for the podcast, I had interviewed the boys along with McAvoy for something else. And that's what we started off talking about. So there you go. Now you know. Enjoy.
I'll make myself sound good in post. I will not eat those biscuits.
Yeah, that was really nice interview, man. Enjoyed that.
Thank you. That was fun.
We had the meerkats on before, yeah. We had
the meerkat. He was
the guy doing the voice.
Yeah. He was like, Sergey, what are you on about?
Oh my god.
Simples. He didn't do simples though, did he?
Oh, really, he didn't do simples.
Though. He didn't do simples.
I promise if I'm sitting back, I'm not disengaging.
He's really just relaxing after a long day. Yeah. What's the questions of the Compare the Market guys like?
So it was kind of comedic twists and things. It was like, what's your favourite? How many times have you lied to get a job?
So he does it as Sergey.
Yes, like Sergey.
Is it Sergey or Alexander?
Both of them, mate. He did both of them. And he switched like
that. He does both?
Yeah. And he's also the guy from Partridge. Partridge, who plays Geordie.
Mr. Partridge, sir.
Yeah, Mr. Partridge, like, I'm a big fan.
I should not be doing accents for you guys because it feels like bringing a knife to a gunfight.
Oh, yeah, that was awful.
We're talking about accents in this movie, and both of you do incredible American accents that have a tinge of Scottish in there from time to time.
Yeah.
But Samuel, you, of course, are English, so that's a different level of difficulty.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, man. Especially like Dundee's not really one that you hear. You hear Glaswegian, you hear Edinburgh. You don't really hear like the other regional parts of Scotland, really. So it was like one I'd not really been introduced to before. So it was like very, very daunting. Like I was up there with like a crew full of Scots. You know what I mean? Like, so I had to get it right.
Extra emphasis.
Yes.
So like when you do the accent and stuff, you obviously work with an accent coach, but then you like just try and surround yourself.
What do you think was the easiest way into it? Like, was it the accent coach or being surrounded by it?
The documentary was good. And just to have his voice in my ears and stuff like that was good. And listening to the songs as well, because they did a lot of songs where they were actually Scottish. Stuff like that helps.
I keep it in my psyche. Honestly, I don't know how he did that. Hear a lot of bad. We've grown up on bad Scottish accents on films, haven't we? With Americans
playing. What are you talking about?
Nothing specific.
I was terrified.
Every time
I do an accent.
Spent bars here on the podcast.
I'm always scared. Like, and I was very, very scared throughout the whole thing.
Just a double check, because this is your actual accent right now. You're not doing another.
Yeah, imagine we should silly embrace you on your own podcast.
And you go on another podcast, you got a completely different accent.
Yeah, it's your English accent again.
And Seamus, obviously, a little bit easier in terms of your way into the Scottish accent, I'm guessing. But
yeah, it was interesting because Gavin is actually from South Africa. He moves to Motherwell and he then goes to uni in Dundee, which is not all in the film. There's no time to tell that story. Like James has touched on, there was a lens of the film. There was an avatar, which is the boys' relationship.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a biopic of Gavin's life. To kind of simplify it, I'm kind of doing an East Coasty accent, a wee bit of Dundee, but because he's kind of a bit of a cultural nomad, he's not really so engrossed in that kind of sound. So, and I want him to kind of feel a bit unplaceable, you know?
But he's really interesting because like, the minute we meet him, he's clearly someone who's very uncomfortable in social situations.
Yeah.
And he holds himself back
an
awful lot.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I don't know if that was something that was
It's yin and yang, isn't it? Like, I'm very much the yin that brings him out of that, and he's the yang that takes me into the other side of things, you know?
We needed each other, didn't we?
I was terrified, mate. Pre-shoot, I was really nervous, and I actually wasn't in a great place mentally prior to shooting. So the character kind of met me at an interesting time where I did feel a bit insecure, a bit nervous as my first film. Yeah, I didn't quite know what I'm doing. But that kind of shows. But I do personally feel more comfortable acting, like, and performing than day-to-day life. I kind of struggle with. I feel really aligned doing that, and Gavin certainly does when he's doing his thing. That's what his purpose is. Yeah, so I really connected with that.
You can channel a bit of that in there.
Aye.
So did you both have those feelings in the way of nerves and the build up? And
yeah, man, we were speaking about it yesterday, and you said you couldn't really see it in me, man, but I was very, very scared. Working with him, he's done a lot of accents himself, and he's a Scot, and he's a massive actor. He's James McAvoy.
Absolutely.
It was like, you want to get it right for him. Do you know what I mean? You want to make sure that his decision, he's made the right decision. Do you know what I mean? You don't want him to regret casting it.
That you constantly have an imposter syndrome.
So you're always like, my God, my God, my God.
I think everyone in every sector is feeling like that. I think it's an important thing to remember that we're all scared.
But
do it anyway.
He must be terrified as well.
Oh, mate, 100%. How's he going to talk to these actors? How, like, the things he was saying in that interview with you, like, are they going to respect my notes? I'm sure he has but there was no question. We all we all sound terrified making this film.
I know, it's like the thing they say about lions. If you meet them in a wild, they're just as scared of you as you are.
I don't think so.
They can kill me with one swipe of their mighty paws. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it is honestly, it's such an assured, confident directorial debut from him. And one of the great things about it is how natural the performances seem. Genuinely, it feels like you two guys have known each other for years.
Yeah.
How long did you have when you first met until filming began to kind of create that sense of history and chemistry?
Well, we booked the job in the 1st of January 2024. Feels like so long ago now.
I had
a year to wait until filming. I was filming Outlander, and then I got some prep done. But we had about 6 weeks of skateboarding and prep work, including the shoot.
And
2 weeks of prep. So skateboarding and recording.
2 or 3 weeks it might have been.
Yeah, maybe it was longer than
of
that.
Of like making the album, not making the album, making all the songs that are in the film.
Six songs. Right.
Like six songs that we had to make. So that was a great experience. First time for us both together.
Being in a studio and experience. Going for pints and living in Glasgow and literally improvising in the streets of Glasgow. Like,
and then, so having the same experience.
Trying to get that bond and that carefree vibe, you know?
Like, we brought each other like, we had a great instructor called Hayden Beck, I think his name, last name is. And like, he's so class. It was me, Seamus and Hayden, and we're just bringing each other on like every day. Like, oh,
and the culture
cool.
of
oh,
it,
can you
know?
Do this? And that's real, like, proper skate culture to push each other and like,
exactly.
Be there for each other.
Things
like,
you can
really
do with your
cool,
pal like, that you wouldn't be able to do by yourself is a big theme of the film. The friendship.
Me and him padded up. Padded up to 9.
Oh, yeah.
Gear.
Not very cool, though, we'd be... You know,
not very cool. There's like 7-year-olds passing us doing ollies and that at the slipping skate park.
That's amazing. What about the rapping side of things? Is that something that comes naturally?
It didn't come naturally, did it?
But it did, if you think about it.
Yeah, it did. But like, there's lots of things I underestimated with it. Like, I thought I'd be able to go into it like seamlessly, but I couldn't. Like,
oh, it wasn't seamless.
Loss of breath. Like, you've got like a piece of. Like of like poetry, basically, is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
From start to finish, it's really hard to get through with like picking the timing and the breath.
It's like going for a Shakespeare monologue and what thoughts lead to which, and when you get your breaths right, so you can flow into this whole sentence and map it out, get your tongue around it. Literally, it was a lot to do.
You have to pronunciate the words really clearly,
sing it out. We recorded. We went to Abbey Road to record it.
It's got to be clear enough for an American audience and a English Scottish, like, you know,
just highlighted in crazy annotations on it. If you saw our things, it was a lot of fun, but a lot of work. We'd just been
When did you first rap on camera?
When did we first rap on camera?
I think it was like early days in Dundee
in the park.
in the park.
Okay. We're sitting trying to pronounce the American accents and just and doing
Yeah.
And we're sitting on the bench and we're just running it.
Because it's on YouTube.
And a lot of those wee moments, James would just, you know, kind of slip into film and he sometimes wouldn't always see action. He'd just be like, we'd be kind of
improvising
a little bit before and then he'd just like, he'd catch us doing it. So
it was just like, keep going.
Because we just try and do it before the take and just ease into it, so... That was cool.
That's amazing. What about crowds though? There's a scene in the movie, big sequence actually at the Barrowlands.
Yeah,
in Glasgow.
That was massive.
Which I imagine was big for Mr. McAvoy.
Oh, it was big.
He pulled that off because of again Scottish like guerrilla warfare style of like putting a message out, call to arms, and the people of Glasgow rallied.
Yeah,
literally like he's like, I'm doing a gig, come along. You'll see too. But honestly, Glasgow crowd, man,
massive.
They turned up. Dressed in the early noughties attire.
No
here
phones,
for a good time. No phones. Committed to the bit. Fully.
Yeah.
And they, so we had a wee gig on prior to the show.
Right.
Me and Sam have been performing it, honestly, like 80 times. And yep. I don't over-exaggerate that. We've done about 10 rehearsals of it, coming back, doing it music, dancing. There's a choreographer coming up from London. It was all dead, quite rushed.
Yeah.
I'm feeling sick. We're sitting there with Lucozade tablets and fans and I'm losing my voice.
Workout, like.
Then we hear 2,000 people strolling through the baddest doors and when they like a gig, they fucking slam the floorboards. It's a dance floor.
Yeah, so they're
hitting their heels like that.
Yeah.
Ready for us coming on. We've got a one-take shot backstage coming in flying. James Rhodes on the handheld camera.
Mm-hmm.
It was just like, we're making a movie.
Yeah, it was mental.
Jesus. And of course, it's a very fractious moment in your relationship as well in the movie. So you got to do
completely,
that.
Completely, yeah. Got to act as well as like run around. Stay in time. It was freaking hard,
scene.
Man. I had a wig on as well. Like, I'm running around on stage, these hot lights and that. Like I had like a woman coming in, fanning my my hairline every after every take. I'm like,
Bill, we were terrified backstage. I was just steaming my voice. Also, my school friends just rocked up backstage. But I was like, "What the hell are you doing here?" They're like, "We came to see your gig." I was like, this is the last thing I want. I'm in character, you know, I'm in costume.
You didn't talk for the like last half an hour of it. You're in
just
that
steaming,
thing, steaming his voice. I'm like, what's that, bro? He's like, he's just checking his head.
Yeah, what is it? Explain steaming for people who don't
your
know.
Voice is just getting moisture to your larynx.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, because I've been singing all day, rapping all day, shouting that I've lost my voice. So I needed to steam, and I think it kind
of
helped.
A bit of eucalyptus, bit of menthol, something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, luckily I had a team of people helping me out.
We're doing hardcore eucalyptus backstage.
Yeah. Yeah, baby.
But that sequence, I can't imagine what it was like as well. You know,
I think
it was actually the Barrowlands.
Yeah, I went to see Libertines like a week before.
Right. It's the best venue,
in the
mate.
Same place, and I was like, literally stood on the other side of the barrier.
So cool.
It was so surreal to be like on stage looking down at where I'd just been stood.
Genuinely, crazy, nothing compares to it.
No, nothing does compare to it. It feels like a fever dream and like you can't really explain it to your friends or family that weren't there because
my sister's
it feels like a. It feels like, we'll never do that again, so it feels like a dream. You just have really, once and you can never get back again. Like,
so fun, man. It's actually fucking
day before your birthday as well, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah.
What a birthday present, man.
Filming the next day.
That's amazing. Do you also have scenes opposite James?
Yeah,
terrifying.
It was terrifying because he plays a terrifying guy, and like, obviously he's a brilliant actor. And he's like looking directly into our eyeballs with that piercing gaze.
He's got a terrifying stare if he wants to turn it on.
Oh my god! Yeah.
Terrible.
I love that scene in the car when like we've just performed the batters. I'm like, yo, the songs came out. He's flipping out. Mary's leaving him. I'm like, come on, dude. and then James pulls in
the car
drive away driver and just sits and stares at us like that.
Yeah. As a director and an actor in the film, did he have other people giving him notes during this performance? Did he have other people watching his performance or was he very much on top of
one person trying to give him notes? They got fired pretty soon. I'm joking.
For the avoidance of any doubt.
That is a joke.
Yeah.
A joke.
That was 100% true.
No, I mean, he had conversations with the DOP and stuff about like, how things wanted to look. And if he was in, that's the only person that he'd confer with about something like that, maybe would be James Rhodes.
I think he would tell you, he talked to him with John Baird.
John Baird,
So I think they talked a lot. So yeah, he tried to he talked about his influences in film and stuff like that and little things he'd put in there and stuff. But it felt, I don't know, it felt like James McAvoy. You were talking to James McAvoy. It didn't feel like... He's just himself. Like, he'd just be in the corner of shots with a handheld camera, like, watching it, playing. It felt easy and just joyful. Mm. Like, yeah.
He's a great boss to have, man.
Aye.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, 6 or 7 weeks we got to spend time with him and, like, soak all that stuff up. Like, even the question I asked him earlier on for the in the podcast, guys, if you're on the plane, you'll know what I'm on about.
I asked him, I don't even know what I asked him, but it's like, just listening to his answers, just like, so lucky to, like, be able to experience that. You know,
right? Yeah.
He's got a great career.
What was your last day like? And what was your rap gift?
Our last day was in London. What was our rap gift? Well, we got these amazing watches, didn't we?
The watches, yeah, not long ago.
We got these custom watches. The same
JP Monaghan?
JJ Monaghan, I think.
JJ. It's either JJ Morgan, which is wrong, or
JP Morgan.
JJ Monaghan.
Financial people, yeah, sponsored, though.
Just so they'll send us all freebies, there was JJ.
A couple grand in the cash.
JJ Monaghan?
JJ Monaghan, yeah.
Monaghan.
JP Morgan wants to send me a few.
Great. JP, you listen?
We've got our own California Scheming watches. They're like black and yellow, and it says California Scheming, get rich or lie trying.
And it's in LA time and Dundee time.
Yeah. Which is nice. Which is like
LA time, baby.
They're not on your wrists right now. So
no.
What the hell?
I know we've left them at home, but I have been wearing mine this week.
All right. Round the house.
This week, round the house, and that. Not to the most important. Yeah. You know, thing that I should have wore it for. Like the press
just in the shower.
So just to double check, these are not going on eBay. Is that where they are?
Let's check right now.
They got a bidding war from at the moment.
Yeah. Because I saw one and pinted a few.
Oh, shush.
Yeah, anyway, I gotta let you guys go. But this has obviously been an amazing experience for you. And Sam, what are you drinking?
So we've got our own. with a great story that we got gifted a big crate of Iron Brew in Toronto by a radio station. We was then walking through our hotel reception, saw
what?
Saw
Ethan Hawke.
Saw Ethan Hawke. I'm bad with names, though. I needed him to.
JP Hawk
is there. Who was like,
PJ
Monaghan. What's that? And we're like, oh, it's Iron Brew, mate. If you want an Iron Brew, you can have one.
He's like, okay, cool, man. Yeah, like, he put it in his back pocket. And then me and Lucy and Sam something the next day. He's like, oh, thanks for the Iron Brew. Delicious.
He actually had Iron Brew.
Yeah, he banned it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's amazing. Because I do have to let you go, but Sam, I couldn't help but notice as we were talking, you were drinking from the bottle. I was like, he's not drinking Iron Brew. There's no way he's drinking Iron Brew.
He's a full Scot now, yeah.
Honorary Scotsman, man.
Made of good.
Starting pubes and everything, you know.
Well, listen, I think on that note, that's a good one.
Yeah. No.
Brilliant. Seamus, Sam, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, man.
Thank you.
Thanks, man.
That was wonderful.
Thank you.
Cheers, guys.
All right, that was Seamus McLean Ross and Samuel Bottomley talking about California Scheming, which is in cinemas right now. Go catch it. I thoroughly recommend it, even if you have to put on an American accent to worm your way into the cinema. Okay, one last interview this week, and it is for another film that is already out in cinemas. You, Me, and Tuscany is the rom-com that sees Reggae Sean Page and Halle Bailey, who were on last week's The Interviews Fact Fans, fall in love in You'll Never Guess Where... Tuscany. The movie is the latest from Uber producer Will Packer, the force behind movies like Ride Along, Girls Trip, and Idris Elba vs. a Lion movie, Beast, which could simply have just been called Idris Elba vs. a Lion. And when Will Packer came to London recently, I spoke to him and the movie's director Kat Quiro together about the working relationship, Quiro's cameo in the movie, Packer's philosophy about producing, and much, much more. Enjoy. Will, Kat, welcome to the Emperor Podcast. How are you both?
Really good. Good to be in London. I like it here.
It's amazing.
It is. It's a little chilly for me, but Kat loves it.
I think he just doesn't have a proper jacket.
That may be true.
I thought it was warm.
I brought shorts. I didn't know. I mean, it is. It's like almost April. It's supposed to be warm. What's happening?
It was warm 2 days ago. That was it for the year. We're done now.
By the way, every time I come to London, it was warm 2 days ago, just so you know.
That's what they say.
That's a and also our warm is very different from other people's warm.
Very true.
Our warm is like 10 degrees and then it's like guns out. But you guys, of course, you know, you shot this in Tuscany.
I love guns out.
You don't want to see my guns. But you guys shot this in Tuscany, of course. I imagine, I mean, it looks horrific, the conditions that you shot this movie in.
Yeah.
Are you okay? You know, do you need counseling?
It was a huge sacrifice.
Oh, horrific.
Yeah,
you said it looked horrific.
No.
Like, it looked horrible.
Horrible. It was just as horrible as it looks being there. The food, the wine, the backdrops.
Yes, the pasta. It was my first time actually being in the region. I had never been. Obviously, there are worse places to film. It was really important. One of the things that I give Kat so many props for is when you have a rom-com, it really works when the backdrop is not just a location. When it steps through and really becomes a character, which people say, but it's hard to do. Mm. Like, you actually have to have nuance and texture for the culture, the people, the food, the vistas, all the things. Kat spent a lot of time thinking about that. And I really feel like it comes through when you see the movie.
Well, I, you know, for me, it was such a fundamental part of making the movie work, because this is about a young woman who falls in love with a man. Yeah. But it's also about falling in love with a place and a family and food and wine and ultimately falling in love with yourself in this environment.
There's a pivotal scene. I won't give too much away, but it takes place in a vineyard, a beautiful, you know, grapes as far as the eye can see. And was that something that you guys saw and you went, okay, this is somewhere we need to film?
Oh man, we searched for that vineyard far and wide, because vineyards essentially are just hallways to all you filmmakers out there. It's just a hallway, a very narrow hallway where it's hard to put cameras in. And there are two directions that you can look. And so finding that vineyard that happened to have the mountains behind it and faced in exactly the right direction completely opened up that scene. So we weren't just in a green hallway.
It's a hallway, but it's a damn sexy hallway, Kat.
That one is. Some of them are not.
Kat would drive to work every day and find locations. Like, we did full location scouts, like the way you properly do.
Production crazy.
And then the morning of the shoot, she would say, I know where we're shooting tomorrow. And I would say, yeah, Kat, it's on the schedule. No, I passed a vineyard today. I saw a vista. It looked amazing. We have to shoot there tomorrow. Here's the thing. She was right. You see the locations in the film. Many of them she found just driving in on the way to work, and they would be incredible. You're absolutely right.
I wake up every day and be like, oh my God, look at this sunrise, and call the DP and be like, you got to get out there and shoot the sunrise. We have like 30 sunrises that we shot in this film. If anyone needs some stock footage.
So all my producers out there, get you a director like Kat, but also get you like some Xanax too, because she is definitely going to drive you crazy, but it will absolutely be worth it. Okay.
Will, you wrote a book recently called Who Better Than You?
Yeah.
And essentially, you have three tenets of life, essentially. One of which is be arrogant, which as a Brit, I just can't do. I'm the worst there is at being arrogant. the other one is, there's another two, is embrace the art of a pivot, which I imagine as a producer is something that's very, very important. And absolutely. The other one is be selective about your circle. So are you selective about your circle as a producer in terms of choosing your directors as well?
Yes, I'm only as successful as I have been blessed to be because of the people that I have worked with. You are only as strong as your team.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes, just because you are close with somebody or get along with them, that doesn't mean that that's the right person that you want to be in partnership with. You want to be in partnership with somebody that has a skill set that benefits whatever it is the ultimate goal is for the movie. And then if you happen to get along with them, like Kat and I, always laughing and having fun, that's even better. But you have to be very unflinching in terms of picking the right people to attain your goals. And I do believe that.
Kat, in a way, do those guidelines apply to you as well? I mean, there's, you know, as a director, be arrogant, embrace the art of the pivot. Are these things that apply to you also?
Oh, 100%. I listened to Will's book on audio, his audio book, which I highly recommend. And he's won many awards for it. And I listened to it on a road trip with my entire family. And it's a great book. It has such solid and simple advice about being a collaborator, really. And, you know, I always say my job as a director is like being the conductor of an orchestra. I have to know what everybody does, but I hope that they're better than me. I need that first violin and that first cello to come in to make the song sing. And so I really do consider my job as bringing together the absolute best people and creating an environment where they can feel free to be their best selves and to play and to feel safe. You know, I always say about a film like this, a rom-com, you cannot direct chemistry, right? We were very lucky to get two actors who have chemistry together and who play off each other really well. And so then my job becomes setting the table so that they can feel comfortable playing with each other.
So when did you know that Reggie Jean Page and Halle Bailey had chemistry? Did you do a lot of chemistry tests beforehand, or was it very much going on faith?
No, they were our first choices, the two of them for the role. And they went, I believe the first time they met was at the Met Gala. So they're in New York at the Met Gala, and Kat sent me a photo of the two of them. And we said, oh my God,
they look
incredible. These are the leads of our, how lucky are we? Mm-hmm. And then we got to Italy and we were doing a table read in Rome, our first table read. And we saw right then, oh, they're already finding a rhythm. Like they are finding within their characters ways that they are going to play off of each other. That's just going to augment what's on the page. Mm-hmm. So we knew very early on that we had something and that the chemistry there was real. And audiences can sense it. They can tell inauthenticity. They've got too many choices now. And so that's the other thing that I say to filmmakers is you want to make sure that you're making a film that is absolutely as authentic as possible because your audience can tell. So we definitely lucked out with the two of them. And then Kat did absolutely just enough to fan those flames and they took it from there.
How did you fan the flames?
Well, they are very opposite. Their characters are very opposite. And so it really was allowing them to suss each other out and to play with each other. And I've heard them talk a little about the process. And what they really appreciated was, yes, we got what was on the page, but we also played. There's a little montage where they're drinking wine before they run out into the vineyard. And a lot of that is not the scripted, the scene.
Right.
A lot
right.
of that is the cameras rolling while they're playing with each other and laughing. And we're talking about this environment we're in and we're maybe accidentally drinking some real wine. And, you know, so there's a playfulness to it that that I think really comes through. And I always start with the script and what's on the page, and then I let them be themselves, really.
I love that, accidentally drinking some wine. How did this wine get in here?
I know nothing about that.
As the
proper producer who is responsible for everyone's well-being, I can neither confirm nor deny if there was real wine ever drank on set. I just know there was a lot of giggling between my leads and my director that day. I'm like, what's happening? I mean, it's funny, but what's going on here?
But that scene as well, the scene in the vineyard, Kat, you make a cameo in that.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh boy.
That is a blonde woman from Ohio.
You have to stay. Not only does she make a cameo in the film, but don't leave when you go see this in the cinemas. Don't leave because we got something fun in the end credits. And then you get to see just how fun old Kat Coro really is.
You know, my one condition in taking that role was that Will be the guy watching behind the monitor to make sure what was happening was funny. So he had some pretty funny direction he yelled out to me. I can't say it on this podcast.
Oh, you can say it on this podcast. We can say anything on this podcast.
I don't know if I want to. I have to maintain some sense of authority.
Please don't. It was a good time, a little bit of a role switch. But I will tell you this, Kat as an actress needs no direction. That's what I'll say.
I mean, you're absolutely right. In the outtakes, you know, Kat, there's a run where you are just ad-libbing and improving. I guess improving. So were those things that you know, you had a list of alts that you wanted to get in? Were you just going off the top of your head?
I love that you're asking this serious question about your acting technique. Let me tell you, Kat had a full backstory for this character. So when you guys see the film, like, there are directors that do cameos. You know, they may walk by, they may say one line. No, one of the biggest laughs in this film is Kat's character when she sees the moment between Hallie and Reggae in the vineyard and sprinklers are going everywhere and there's a lot of sexiness and all the things are happening. Enter Kat, and that's all I can tell you. You have to see it, but listen, she's promising. A lot of people have been asking about the sequel, and I'm all for it. They think the sequel is with Hallie and Reggae. The sequel is with Catherine from Ohio. I think that's how we credited her. And she's our horny tourist. That's what I'll say. You guys can take it from there.
Now you can imagine the direction he gave me a little bit. But, you know, look, it was out of necessity. We were in the middle of Tuscany. There weren't a lot of American speaking actors. And we
necessity. She had no choice. I love it. I've never heard this story.
You know what's funny is it is true, though. We did some auditions.
You
had
to. You didn't want to. You were forced to. That would have
was. I kind of was.
There was some, but, some wine accidentally found its way onto the set. And next thing I know, I was.
She gets it. She gets it.
I know how this thing works.
It's like you've known us our whole career. You get it.
But, you know, all joking aside, let's get serious.
Yep.
That little role was a little nod to Diane Lane in Under the Tuscan Sun.
Oh, yes, of course.
And the film is kind of filled with little Easter eggs of rom-coms that we love, that we kind of put a little hint in there of it.
So. How about Nia Vardalos?
Yeah, My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
Yes, absolutely. She flew over. I think she was in Greece at the time and flew over and blessed us with a nice little cameo. Nothing like a good Easter egg in a rom-com.
Precisely. So the sequel could be You, Me, and Ohio.
Hello. Now you're talking.
Come on. I don't want to. Well, no, I love Ohio. I'm not going to say anything. I love it. It's beautiful.
I could just picture it. You guys spending 3 months in the beautiful Ohio sun. Just
not quite the same. Doesn't have the same ring to it.
Do they have vineyards in Ohio? I don't know.
They got yards. We'll get back to you on
they
that.
They have vines.
Yeah, they got vines and they got yards. So there goes our Cleveland box office.
We love you, Ohio. I do love Ohio. Our producer, Joanna's from Ohio.
Yes, she is. Yes. Shout out to Cincinnati.
Very, very quickly, in the outtakes at the end, we do get to see the clapperboard for the film as you were shooting it. And the movie was originally called Italiana. Now it is called You, Me, and Tuscany. Talk about the art of the pivot. Why the name change?
It was marketing, actually. So when we got the script, it was called Italiana, which, you know, was great from our Ryan Ingle because her name is Anna. She ends up in Italy. And when you see the film, Italiana does still thematically make an appearance in the movie. But I think that we felt, along with our great marketing folks, that You, Me, and Tuscany just had a different ring to it. Like you got what the movie was. It's a little more whimsical and fun. And at the end of the day, you've got to be able to make a great film, but then you got to be able to sell that film. Because as I said, audiences have got all kinds of things being pushed on them all the time. So you need something that's going to stand out and cut through. So I love Italiana, but I think You, Me, and Tuscany, that's the winner.
Well, also, and you see in the movie, there's some confusion over the pronunciation of Anna versus Anna. And that is confusing in Italiana because her name is actually Anna. So then is it called Italiana? It opens up this whole can of worms that we just didn't want to deal with.
Yeah, Italiana doesn't have the same ring either.
Anna.
It paves the way for You, Me, and Ohio. So all is good. All is
good. But like
good.
That little moment, you know, going back to what we got from the Italian, you know, flavor was that whole Anna bit came from me being on set and hearing everybody say Anna. And then I'd say, her name's Anna. And they'd say, yes, Anna. And it was so funny. It happened really early on in production where they would say, yes, I'm saying Anna. Anna, Anna. And so we end up putting that in. It's one of my favorite little moments. That's there.
A lovely note on which to end. Will, Kat, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks so much for your time.
Great interview. Thanks for having us, brother.
Cheers. All right. That was Will Packer and Kat Coiro. And that is it for this week's episode of The Interviews. Now, I'm not sure if there's going to be an episode next week as I'll be away on an actual holiday. So there's a good chance that we might refer it back to the multi-interview format for the regular Mothership Empire podcast for 1 week only, because we have a lot of guests on the pod that comes out April 24th, and I'm not around to edit the interviews beforehand, so we might have to put them all into one show, but we'll see what happens there. Speaking of the regular Empire podcast, Brian Cox, no, not that one, the other one, is our guest on this week's show, talking about his directorial debut, Glenn Rothen. So make sure to listen to that show, which is out on Friday, April 17th, and it sees Helen O'Hara host in my stead, and she'll be talking about, well, I have absolutely no clue because I'm recording this on Sunday night, 4 days before they even record it. All part of the holiday rush, isn't it? I'm getting shit done. I'm getting shit together. Anyway, tune in to find out what they're talking about. It's going to be exciting. And on that note, that is it for me. I'm off to drink a personalized bottle of Iron Brew. Only problem is, it's not named after me. Let's see who it is named after. What the? Lee Cronin's Iron Brew? Huh, that guy gets everywhere. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.
The weather in Central Ohio just got better, so why shouldn't your loan rate? CME Federal Credit Union wants to try to beat your current loan rate by 2% on autos and toys. Plus, enjoy no payments for 90 days on car loans and no payments for 60 days on motorcycles, boats, and more. With car rates as low as 4.99% APR and toy rates starting at 6.5% APR, it's the perfect time to save. Apply today at cmefcu.org.
Terms apply. Minimum floor rates, 4.99% APR cars, 6.50% APR, other vehicles, federally insured by NCUA.